You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Carrie Koplinka-Lehr. Carrie, it's good to have you here today.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Eric.
So Carrie, the way we start the show is with this huge question. Who are you? What do we need to know about you as a person, what you aspire to, what you value, what you've done to start the conversation?
Yeah, so I would describe myself as an empath, a person who feels very deeply. I remember one time something had happened in our family, and I said to myself, I feel like I'm bleeding. I wasn't literally bleeding, but I felt like I was.
Yeah.
So I feel the world very deeply, and I think that means that I need to sometimes manage what comes in.
Sure.
So that I don't have too much all the time. I'm a mother. That's been a source of great satisfaction. I'm a wife. I'm a writer. Sometimes I feel like I'm an aspiring writer, which I think is perhaps always true for writers. And I would describe myself as an environmentalist, feeling like the environment needs advocates. And from a very early age, I really wanted to advocate for the environment, primarily through the written word.
Mm-hmm. Well, neat. And we will unpack, I imagine, each piece. those are broad strokes, and we'll take each one of them apart a little bit in the time that we have in the show.
Mm-hmm.
When you said empathic, but you used a visceral metaphor, bleeding.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes that whole notion of empathy in a slightly different direction,
mm-hmm.
from emotion to physical rendering,
mm-hmm.
and that's not always what's meant by empathy. So that was kind of a powerful note.
Mm-hmm.
So you brought some music with you.
I did.
And you wanted to start with Sentimental, Jean-Pierre Rampal and Claude Bolling's piece together on a great album that came out, I think, when I was in college.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
So would you want to say anything about it before we play it?
Yeah, this song was introduced to me by a college roommate, and her name was Tori. She was a musician, and her family were musicians up in Syracuse. And when she played it for me, I was completely in love with it. And in fact, I think she gave me the album that I still have today. But it seems to say things that words can't. And for me, that's the value of music. Just listening to it, first of all, it's just so beautiful.
Right.
And, you know, it's one of those songs that can make you cry in a good kind of a way,
mm-hmm.
Just because it's tapping into something that you can't say.
Right, right. And I, you know, the first music song that ever made it to the number one top hit that did not have words was Classical Gas,
mm-hmm.
and it has this kind of a driving. It's kind of smooth on one level, but incredibly complex on another level. In a certain sense, that album had the same quality of that hit
came did.
About 10 years earlier.
Yeah, and I debated about Classical Gas. I thought, oh, I love that one too. It was hard to choose.
That's very funny. That's very, very funny. So here we go. We're going to play probably about a third or half of it.
That sounds great.
Here we go.
Thank you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Carrie Kaplinka-Lair. So, Carrie, where I'd like to go is, looking back on the life, given the life that you enjoy and appreciate living now, what were the experiences that you needed to have to know this is where you need to be now?
I think one of the experiences that I needed to have was growing up in White Plains, New York. It was a fairly metropolitan area, and we lived at the northern end of it, and so I was able to go to a fairly small school. I went to Valhalla High School, which spanned, you know, quite a few grades, very small graduating class. I think it was like 100 or so. And as I look back, amazingly diverse. I was able to go to school with, black and brown people, a lot of folks who had settled there to create the Kensico Dam, and their relatives went way back. So it was, in a way, that was a tremendous experience for me, and it introduced me to a lot that I might not have had growing up elsewhere. But also, that area is very business-oriented, and I found my values diverging with a lot of the values of the people around me. A lot of malls, and IBM is located there in Armonk, and so I started really craving a more rural life, and my family had taken quite a number of vacations up in Vermont, and just something resonated with me about that. So I was lucky enough to be able to choose a college. My mom went to work so she could help afford to pay for that. And so I chose Colgate, which is kind of in the middle of a cornfield in Madison County, New York.
Right, right.
And, I found plenty of people who were interested in business and, some things that I was not. But then there was a core group of people who were really interested in the environment. And I went there for environmental studies in English. So I think I needed to know what I didn't want to try to gravitate toward what I did want.
Right. But you were immersed in it long enough for you to both understand it and to let it go without being rigid in a rejection of it, or reactionary.
Yeah.
So, do you miss any of it, or is it a complete break?
You know, I hadn't thought that I missed some of it until recently. My parents are in the process of selling their home that they lived in for 40 years. And before that, we lived in the same neighborhood as a family for pretty much my entire life. And neighbors were coming by to say goodbye. And it was very touching for me to see that community and, to know that there were people in the church who were going to wonder, where do my parents go? My teacher from second and third grade lives a few houses down from my parents. We went to say goodbye to her. And I thought, these are my roots, even though I had perhaps rejected them, at least geographically.
You reject the lifestyle in some sense, yeah.
Yeah. So, it's surprising as you get older and older, things that you think didn't mean anything to you take on new meaning, but sometimes have to have life experiences that make you appreciate them.
Right. And I sense that it's partly sentimental, but it's also just partly contextual.
It is.
It's just that that was something that really worked for you.
Mm-hmm.
And it was good, even though it wasn't what you wanted next.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And where you went next was Colgate. And part of the next was the relationship with the person who gave you the Jean-Pierre Rampal album.
Exactly. Yeah. And even with Colgate, I was one of the first classes of women at Colgate. Uh-huh. And as I chose Colgate, I thought, this is just going to be so cool. There are going to be a lot of guys there, which is somewhat ridiculous.
Also a little counter some of your values, too. So.
So I went there and then I realized, wow, this is hard. This institution is not used to having females here. and there is a lot of sexism. Mm-hmm. And so women banded together, and there were some very strong relationships because of that. But I carried resentment toward Colgate up until a few years ago, when the chaplain who was at Colgate, who actually performed the marriage ceremony for me and my husband who came from Colgate, when he passed, the outpouring of the community that came back mm-hmm. to remember him was astonishing, like salt of the earth people. And it was so funny all these decades later to feel like I was coming home. Mm-hmm. But I really was. And I think some of the resentment had faded away. And I was able to embrace Colgate. I was actually able to give financially to Colgate in the name of this chaplain, uh-huh. like with a whole heart.
Right, right.
You know, because we were asked and also because I really wanted to.
Right. Where had the resentment lived in you? What purpose did it serve until you no longer had it?
Yeah, it was sort of a fire in the belly. Like physically, I think it lived in my gut. Uh-huh. And I think I'm probably stronger because of it. And I also encouraged my children, who are all female, four of them, to really go for it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And to, you know, I don't want to say fight for what they wanted to, but to work really hard. Like I'd go to their cross country meets. Uh-huh. I was in cross country in high school, but there was no other team to go against, you know? So it's okay, yeah. I've done this training. And essentially the coach said to me, yeah, good luck. Right. And that really came back to me. When I watched them run, and it was this overwhelming sense of go for it. Now is a different time, and do this for yourself, and kind of do it for me.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, it's interesting how we're shaped by experiences like, you know, women at an institution being excluded. And Colgate really didn't quite know what to do with us yet.
Right. It invited you, but it didn't include you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you started to say something about Tori, the person who gave you the record, but I didn't know quite
so
how to lead into
there's
that.
There's a funny story yeah. about sure. Tori and my life right now. And that is that we lived in a place called Ralph Bunch House. The nickname was Peace House. So he was an advocate for peace. And we lived on the third floor. And I had a major crush on this guy named Mike Lair. And Mike would ride his bike all around. And one day I left a note on his bike asking, you know, if he wanted to, I think it was like go on a bike ride or something.
Right.
I had seen him in Chorus and I was like completely smitten. And so anyway, he biked to Ralph Bunch House and we saw him through the window and he called up and he goes, I can't do that date with you because I'm going to a Harry Chapin concert. You know, I was like, well, that was a pretty good excuse, actually. Uh-huh. And I thought he might be going with another girl, but anyway, he biked off and I turned to Tori and it seemed totally incomprehensible at the time, but I said to her, I'm going to marry that guy someday. And we both broke out into like these peals of laughter. Uh-huh. We fell back on our beds because it was really ridiculous. He was very out of reach. I wasn't even sure he was interested in women at the time. It didn't seem like he was.
It's not a rational statement.
It wasn't a rational statement, and we started laughing about uh-huh. it. And it just seemed very remote at the time.
Yeah. You're the fourth or fifth person I've interviewed who has that story.
Really?
One of my Cornell professors did, too. She saw her future husband walking down the steps of the Federal Court of Appeals in Atlanta, and she said to herself, I'm going to marry that man, not having ever had any interactions with him. But it's this visceral, intuitive kind of connection, and I've had people on the show who've been able to say the same thing. It just comes.
It was astounding.
Yeah. And how many times we say stuff and forget it and it doesn't happen, you mm-hmm. know, maybe in terms of being the rational scientist piece, but it's just really powerful when mm-hmm. it does. Mm-hmm. And there's a sense of wholeness, completion, you know, fulfillment mm-hmm. that follows.
Yeah. I mean, there are actually just a handful of times in my life when I have felt like another force was moving besides mine.
Right.
And I would say that happened with Mike. Mm-hmm. And it was palpable.
Mm-hmm. That is a beautiful story. Let's cut to music. What should we play next?
Great. Let's do Isn't She Lovely?
Okay. Yes, and I imagine there's some children's stories coming up. Here we go. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Carrie Kuplinka-Lehr. So, Carrie, I don't know if you want to... We did a brief dance around some of the things that you have experienced that were really important to shaping the life you live now. Is there something else that we should go to before we take up some issues?
I would say a really formative experience was living up in Labrador, Canada, in 1991 to 1993. That was the time that we had accepted a volunteer position as a family, actually, mm-hmm. with Mennonite Central Committee. And so we went to this really remote village. It was 1,000 miles north of the U.S. border, and you couldn't get there by car. You could just get there by plane or by boat. And we were the only white family in a Native American village for 2 years. There were some mixed settler Innu families. Innu's the name of the people, the Innu language, and they're descended from the Cree. We went there with, I would say, the naive notion of helping. Mm-hmm. And as often happens in these situations, I think we were helped to understand how to see Western culture differently.
Right, right. When you go to help or when you go to teach with any measure of humility, you realize very soon I'm the one being helped or I'm the one being taught. You know, it's as much as the other way around.
And it's sort of a platitude. Yeah. And you go and you think, oh, that's not going to be me.
Yeah.
But in fact, you can't get rid of your own bias until you get rid of it.
And also it is humility.
Yeah.
I mean, it is to stand no higher and no lower than the one you are with and to meet as equals.
Yeah. We learned a tremendous amount about community, mm-hmm. people watching over each other's children, adopting informally the other's children, living...
Because of people dying.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever lived in a location where so many people died in such a short period of time. Fire, suicide, freezing, literally in the cold after drinking. Prior to us arriving, drownings. I mean, it was astounding and sobering.
Right. So death was close at hand.
It was.
Always.
Always.
And you had just had the last of your four children.
Actually, up there.
Up there you had mm-hmm. the fourth child.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. how does motherhood figure into that trip?
Yeah, I got a real insight into how high the bar is in the U.S. for performing as a parent. And I thought, oh, it's going to be so hard to go to Labrador. I'm going to have three kids in tow, and I'm going to give birth to another one there. And in fact, giving birth and being a parent in that society was so much easier than I ever imagined. There were no teams to drive your kids to. We didn't own a car.
Right.
It was walking or skidoo, or if someone could give you a ride on a four-wheeler in the sand, you could do that in mm-hmm. the summer months. Mm-hmm. But I had a lot of time with my kids and I had a lot of time with other people's kids and that was a real privilege. So we would, we'd put on music and dance and visiting was part of the culture. So people would come and visit all the time, going on walks. And, I came back and realized, oh, we put a lot of pressure on parents and then kids put pressure on their cohorts to, join this and do that and drive mm-hmm. around. And you kind of run ragged as a parent.
Well, and it's not a shared activity and it's not a communal sport.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So, in terms of parenting, I felt like I had a lot of time mm-hmm. and I really appreciated learning about another culture and how they parent. Mm-hmm. A lot of showing, not telling.
Uh-huh.
You had to really look sharp because people were not going to explain things to you.
Right.
I grew up, learning differently. So it really, it shaped me also as a parent, maybe to not be such a worrywart. it was just so multifaceted that we now use that time period as a marker between what was and what came after that.
Yeah, it's interesting. You're making me think. In most traditional cultures, you aren't told. you are shown.
Yeah.
And I grew up in a more traditional environment than modern, but I was on that so people, I had to learn to explain things largely to people who came into my world because they were wanting to understand what we knew intuitively or picked up by just closely observing others. That's an interesting, it also makes you have to be verbal.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine that some nonverbal people would never want to even find the words because the words take away the fullness mm-hmm. of the experience.
Yeah.
You mentioned in your introduction your role as a mother.
Mm-hmm.
How did being a mother force you to learn things you never anticipated or maybe never wanted to learn? How did it change who you? How did it reshuffle your deck?
I would say that on a daily basis, I'm still struggling with this idea of, no, I don't want to change in that way. And then another voice inside of me saying, you actually don't have a choice.
If you're
going to relate to your kids, then you actually don't have a choice about how much you learn about this topic and whether you want to open up your mind and your heart to it. So for example, I grew up with a mom who basically advocated for abstinence. And, I preached that to my kids until I realized, this ain't working too well.
This is not what's happening here.
And I thought, okay, so they're making different decisions. Hopefully they're well-informed decisions. If I want to stay in relationship with my child, something has to shift. Mm. And what has to shift is my rigidity around this particular topic. Yeah. And, I had this illusion that once my kids were fairly well grown, that I wouldn't have to work so hard as a parent. I wouldn't have to think about child development and develop new ways of saying things and, keep them stimulated through X, Y, and Z, that I could go on vacation or something. And that has proven to not be true up until this moment. I still need to reevaluate who I am and who I am to my children and what my belief system is on a daily basis.
Hmm.
It's shocking to me that it's that much thoughtfulness.
Right.
And it's great, but it's a lot of work. And if you sign off, you sign off at your peril. Yeah. You can kind of have a vacation from it, but then you need to come around.
Right. My mother said that she thought she would raise the kids, but then the kids raised her.
Yeah. I think that's probably true.
It flipped it, and because we went so far away, because we went thousands of miles away, each of us, almost all of us, and that set up a different dynamic. So, and your kids are just in their 20s and early 30s.
The youngest is 25. The eldest is 33.
Yeah.
I'm reminded of, I think it was Yuri Bronfenbrenner who said, "Your children are your teachers."
Mm-hmm.
And he was not kidding.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But I guess just to add to that, I don't know if I've had a more rewarding experience. Just the privilege of being able to be a parent and to see the growth of an infant, all the way up until adulthood is just so miraculous.
Right. I mean, this is a theme that's come up. This is, I think, the third time in this brief conversation about what stretched you to the point you didn't think you could almost do it, and yet it becomes the most meaningful thing.
Mm-hmm. True.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
so, which is, I guess, how we grow.
Yeah. What doesn't kill you makes you grow. in the more extreme version of it. So let's cut to music. I'm going to do the ID while you think what next to play. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest is Carrie Kaplinka-Lair.
So should we do That's the Way of the World?
Sure.
Okay.
Here we go. Thank you.
the West Saints Club.
Listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Carrie Koplinka-Lehr. So, Carrie, part of what is it that you're involved in today? You are a writer. Mm-hmm. You're retired from a career at Cornell. Mm-hmm. You're not yet a grandparent, I guess.
It's getting close.
So what are the issues that keep you going these days?
I'd say one group that I'm involved in is a group that is looking at issues of risk around salt mining. And the group has taken an approach that they believe is based in science. And admittedly, with science, you can have multiple opinions.
Right.
So there are geologists who feel like there's very little risk with salt mining. And there are other geologists, for example, there's one at SUNY Geneseo who feels like, you know, you have tremendous amounts of underground pressure, 2,000 feet, you know, below the bottom mm-hmm. of the lake, and those pressures create faults and that we never know. And this particular individual was very close to the salt mine collapse at Retsov, had studied it extensively, and said, you know, a number of things went wrong simultaneously. So this group has begun to engage with this individual and is taking a pretty, I would say, soft approach of educating people about what the risks are. And it's dicey. You know, I live in Lansing, and Cargill is an employer in Lansing. Mm-hmm. They employ at least 180 people. And I think Lansing depends on that industry. And a lot of people in the Northeast depend on the product, mm-hmm. salt. So we haven't figured out a way to not salt our roads here. So as much as I wanted to sort of stay away from administration and meetings and, you know, reviewing people's materials, I have gotten back into that a little bit with this group as a volunteer, just to learn more. Mm-hmm. And to share more. I don't think very many people in the group are inflammatory, although we've gotten some pressure to be a little bit more inflammatory and a little bit more out there. Mm-hmm. A lot of the folks are pretty measured. So that's one little tiny piece. And another thing that I've been able to get involved in addition to writing articles,
sure.
Has been wildlife rehabilitation. So I've gotten my license to be a wildlife rehabber.
Uh-huh.
And I have now rehabilitated 2 squirrels, which sounds totally ridiculous.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Because they're the kind of thing you see lying on the side of the road. But it was really fascinating. And I realized how smart they are.
Uh-huh.
And every day they would learn something new. And letting them go was actually pretty hard for me. I was very worried about them. I actually lost some sleep one night because it was raining and I was worried about them.
Right.
But it, it, it has really given me a glimpse into the challenges that wildlife face, and how many things are up against them, and how short their lives can be.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I've kind of deepened my understanding, and I've increased my respect for wildlife rehabbers, and also the Swanson Wildlife Center as part of Cornell, where people bring in animals that have been caught by a cat,
mm-hmm.
Creatures that have met some calamity, and they do everything they can to save them. So those are some things that are keeping me active besides the writing.
Right, right, right. I want to ask a little bit about the rehabilitating squirrels. I mean, I come from a culture where we'd eat them.
Right.
I mean, that was you know, we would get a squirrel or a rabbit or you know whatever. I mean, you would eat it. That was dinner. And we had red squirrels in Missouri, so there was not as much. You know, there was not as much to the squirrel once you got it.
You needed a lot of them.
Yes,
right.
That's right. Well, but you know, still you're limited. And learning how an animal lives without, I mean, the protections and the risks are very different than what we perceive as our, quote, human life. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, when you were talking about being in Canada, I'm blocking on the name of where you were.
Up in Labrador, Canada.
In Labrador, yeah. The lives were lived with less protection,
yeah.
And in some sense more vulnerability, because some of the food of alcohol was coming in from the outside, mm-hmm. and creating issues, as it does often for wild animals. But life lived that, and I grew up very much, you know, the rural people were living on the land, very close to the land, and mm-hmm. a devastating winter could have incredible devastating effects mm-hmm. on health, or a fire that would take down the house and kill a number of people. It's a living with the constant presence of vulnerability,
yeah.
and the constant need for responsiveness.
Mm-hmm.
So when you talk about the respect, what is it that you're learning about nature or about these animals as you let them go?
Well, preparation is really important. And so as you prepare to release an animal, you need to expose them to as much as you can while you're protecting them. So, for example, I would begin hiding their food, and they would need to go find their food. And then I would create challenges for them so that they'd have to go up into a box to find their food, and they'd need, you know, climbing. And so you're essentially presenting them with ways to build their skills and gradually introducing them to what life might be like as soon as you take the top off that cage. And again, these are just squirrels. I think it can right. get much more complicated. They're, with a bobcat, for example, recently this team of Cornell vets and a wildlife rehabber released a bobcat that had been hit in Lansing. And, you know, the amount of resource that went behind that was extraordinary. People who were operating on the leg of the bobcat and keeping it safe until it could grow in strength.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the preparation is really key. And it's a journey I'm just at the beginning of.
Right, right.
So I'll go to a conference in November in Binghamton so I can learn a lot more about this. But there's an entire network here of people who are doing it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And just to your point about, you know, our red squirrels for shooting, you know, there's no differentiation made between a bobcat or a squirrel
right,
as people
right.
bring them into the center. It's
right.
kind of like a hospital where, you know, we're not going to judge the value of this creature's life.
Right.
And so they farm out everything, snapping turtles, mice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's amazing to me, because most people, when they hear that I rehabbed squirrels, they start laughing. It's kind of funny. But on the other hand, there's a beauty to not differentiating.
Right. And I guess... to me, and where I would not differentiate is whether you rehab it or whether you eat it. There are very different ways of respecting the animal.
Mm-hmm.
And what I wonder about the bobcat is, having experienced a trauma that severe, is that animal going to be re-traumatized by being entered, or would its life have been fuller by ending then? So there are not clean answers.
No, there aren't.
To any of these questions.
Mm-mm.
And people do what they feel called to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I appreciate. And it kind of comes back to, and this allows us to kind of come back to some of the science and how you approach it. you care deeply for each animal, mm-hmm. and you have an emotional life which allows that, and you know how to be that way. Some people don't have the space in their lives, mm-hmm. and so something goes awry and they kill it, mm-hmm. and that's understandable. It's also part of that environment in which things, there's not the resources, there's not the generosity possible, mm-hmm. either by them or by that situation, mm-hmm. to allow for that care. Mm-hmm. And that is without judgment of good or bad. That's just how people act and react with integrity, mm-hmm. in the moment. You're talking about the science around the salt mining and people. Is it that people are not being incendiary or more aggressive in pushing or promoting the risks of mining because they they care about maintaining this at a calm, rational level? Or is it because that there are many ways to be emotional, but we don't know how to be them all at once?
Interesting. I mean, I can tell you what my take, mm-hmm, is.
Sure.
And having worked very closely with scientists for 25 years, both at Cornell and kind of through Cornell with the land grant system in the Northeast, you know, I met literally hundreds of scientists. I read their grant proposals. I interviewed them for stories. Scientists aren't magicians. They're like doctors. I mean, they do the absolute best they can with the knowledge that they have,
right.
And they're always trying to learn more. And
they're guessing where they don't know.
Yeah, and you can have two well-respected scientists who see something very differently.
Sure.
So, you know, we try to approach any given situation with as much integrity as possible, mm-hmm. and you get the best data that you can, and you interpret it as carefully as you can. But you know, we make mistakes in how we assess things, and then we reassess, and then go at it again. But it's really a very beautiful process to say, okay, I have this hypothesis, I'm going to test this, mm-hmm. and I will do my utmost to get the truth. But then, in fact, as you gain one piece, it sheds a different light on what we thought we knew. And I remember I had this professor actually at Colgate, mm-hmm. Tony Avini, and he really influenced me about how much science was going to reveal and how much of that revelation was going to change in 1 year, 10, 20. Mm-hmm. I said, you know, that what we consider planets will change. Well, he was right about
right.
that. You know, what we think we know is going to change. And I just remember thinking, wow, I used to think it was so much more secure than that, but it's not. So, I mean, back to the salt mine, I think this group, the Cayuga Lake Environmental Action Now Clean, is pointing out what some geologists perceive are important risks to consider.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying, you know what, we might want to pause and take a look at these risks. These are the risks that we know them now. Have you thought about this? And have you thought about mm-hmm. that? And I would consider that a very thoughtful approach. I would want any corporation, and I think most corporations would agree, to be as sustainable as possible. It keeps them going into the future. And also as careful as possible. Mm-hmm. You know, you have these people down in the mines, and you want to protect their lives, and I know that's true.
Right, right, and I guess what I'm trying to get at is to step out of the intellectual knowing, but to know emotionally fully what the mine means, and so the mine means jobs and education and taxes and things that people celebrate with their whole lives,
mm-hmm.
weddings and children and grandchildren and long stories and things. And if you bring that to the table, and then you bring, you know, the environment that formed those salt mines to the environment, to the emotional experience, which is, you know, celebrating the dramatic change, the drying off of oceans, this, you know, the collection of the salt, but also what it would be like to grieve or to mourn the loss of the environment that we have now, mm-hmm. which is a completely destroyed environment from what it was 300 years ago.
It is so true.
But if it were destroyed further by the salinization of the lake or something, how would that grief look? What would that, so that we can fully feel the range of emotions and the visceral responses that we have to everything associated with the experience. Mm-hmm. And then we can make a decision, because it's not just intellectual. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And it can make us feel more. When people want to tell us it's good because it's jobs and families, or it's bad because it's destruction, they're yanking one set of emotions. And if we haven't played them all out, mm-hmm. that's my concern.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
To take the sober judgment that you are reflecting here as a way of having a rational discussion, but also take seriously the full emotional mm-hmm. weight mm-hmm. of the experience of having the mind. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and you know, it's making me think of a quotation by someone who used to study the formation of how letters were created with serifs and sans serifs, and he said, God is in the details. And I thought, wow, that applies to so much of life. So for example, thinking back to the lake, you know, many of us have a very emotional response to the lake, the beauty of it, and then the creatures that live in it, and the perfection in so much of that. And so you're right, even though over millennia it's all changing, when we look at the perfection of the moment, there's something very spiritual about that. Mm-hmm, it's like mm-hmm. looking at a flower.
Right.
And I think there's something inside of us that does not want that to change, or at least not too quickly. And for me, it has something to do with the preservation of the perfection. Mm-hmm. Not that we don't believe that over time it will change, because we know intellectually that it will change.
It will not only change, it will change almost completely.
And it could be, and might be just as beautiful, but I think we perhaps mourn the loss right. as we're experiencing
it. We lost a whole side of the railroad mm-hmm. into the lake with trees from where we have a house. And so on the one hand, that was danger and mourning. It was also clay filled. It was incredibly unstable under the amount of rain we had in late July and, mm-hmm. and early August. And when it went down, for me, that seeing that destruction, and it doesn't threaten the lake, but it's just so much part of it. Mm-hmm. I am of two minds. What do we preserve at what cost? What do we accept? Not with resignation, but with hope that we can work with it, dance with it, and you know, we may be seeing greater. We may see climate destruction with what we've seen in terms of global warming, but we may also see people dance in creative ways that we've never seen.
Yep, that's so true. And that same line of thinking is true with invasive species. You know, I've thought quite a bit about the degree to which we try to eradicate invasive species, whether it's a plant or,
right.
or an animal. And I'm still somewhat undecided. I mean, I have seen the displacement of native species because of invasives.
Sure.
And yet, you know, there's this relentless process of change.
Right. And they're only defined invasive largely because human action brought them here. Because if they'd have migrated by other means, we wouldn't necessarily refer to them as invasive.
Yeah, and considering this all used to be an inland sea,
yes.
everything's
yeah, 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 yeah,
everything
yeah, yeah,
has invaded.
But it calls for the sober reflection that you're talking about mm-hmm. with the Clean Group, Cayuga Lake Environmental Action mm-hmm. Network Group, but it also calls for ways of honoring these strong feelings of fear. Whether we mind it or not, of fear, you know, if anything goes wrong that we can't anticipate mm-hmm. or that we should have anticipated, feeling mm-hmm. of guilt and shame over not having been the kind of people who would have gotten it ahead of time. Mm-hmm. I want to switch gears.
Mm-hmm.
One of the pieces of the show is getting people to share a little bit, asking people to share as they are willing, what they do to take care of themselves mm-hmm. emotionally, intellectually, physically, throughout the day, week, month, year. And how do you know you need to do that?
Oh, well,
what is it? What do you do to care for yourself, and how do you know it's time for me to take a... mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I know that I need to do it because I get crabby, and sometimes I get sad.
Yeah. And you see yourself getting crabby, or do you see the crabbiness in others' reactions to you?
No, I can see it, and I also self-isolate. So I try not to go there. I run just about every day. Mm-hmm. I don't run a long way, and I don't run super fast, but just about every day I get out, and it's almost a form of prayer. Just moving, I think, is very good for my personality type, like physically moving through space.
Right.
And because it's been so beautiful this summer, I also try to swim. And luckily, I can run to the lake, and then I can swim. And that's like a double whammy.
Uh-huh.
Wow, that's really great. What a mood changer.
Right. Right.
You know, I've gone through times where I meditate. And I think what's helpful about that is going to this line of thinking that I don't have to solve any problem right now. I just, for this moment, that's the treat. That's the brain vacation.
It's a stop.
I don't have to solve that. And as soon as I start thinking, you know, like kind of squirrel brain, like I better do this and I better do that. It's like you actually don't have to solve that problem right now.
It's interesting that you use squirrel brain and you're rehabilitating squirrels. I mean, it's
they are very busy and they do a lot of jumping around.
Yes.
And I think I am like part squirrel. Like, oh, I just want to be outside all the time climbing trees.
Right.
I eat really well. I have a garden and grow a lot of vegetables. And I feel like that encourages me to eat those vegetables
right.
and feed them to my family. So I'm eating well. And then I get together with people I love. Luckily, I live with someone I deeply love, Mike. And
that first glance actually stuck.
It stuck. I'm through thick and thin. Yeah. That's a real blessing. It's a blessing to be able to live your life with someone you love. And that is a huge stress reliever much of the time.
When did you learn that you needed to take care of yourself?
Oh my gosh.
That it wouldn't happen automatically or that others wouldn't do it.
It took a long time.
Well, I mean, that's. But we often don't hear that from other people. So how old were you?
What happened? I can tell you a story. Around year 13, I got a letter from some friends, and in the letter, the wife said, well, you know, my husband and I have decided we have some issues to work through, and we're going to go to therapy. And I read the letter, and I started crying.
This was year 13 of your marriage.
Of my marriage, sorry. Yeah, that wasn't clear. I wasn't 13 years old.
Yeah.
So 13 years into the marriage, and I thought, you know, I got this letter, and she said they were going to therapy, and I thought, well, I'm feeling teary about this, and I think that's saying something to me. And at the time, Mike and I were working through some of these different difficult issues of life, of like how much are you acting as an independent agent and how much are you acting as a system?
Right.
So anyway, we went to therapy, and one of the assignments was, okay, Carrie, you are going to take yourself on a date by yourself, and you're going to leave the kids. And I don't care what you do, but you're going to do that for an hour. So set your watch. And I just remember it was my time for the date. I had absolutely no idea what I was going to do. I didn't want to leave the kids. I set a timer and I biked to a nearby field and I read a book and I came back like exactly on the 60 minute mark. And I was kind of like miserable. I was way too attached to the kids.
Uh-huh.
And that was a sign to me that perhaps I needed to look at this issue and figure out ways to take time for myself, because I was giving to the point of getting really wrung out.
Right.
And I didn't think
you
it was
feel whole without them.
Yeah, and I didn't think it was related to my relationship with Mike. I thought, well, that's neither, you know, whether I want to separate from the kids or not is neither here nor there. But in fact, everything's related.
The whole system is
it's
related.
A system.
Yeah.
So that planted the seed. And then obviously as the kids have gotten older, it's been much easier to take time for myself. And now I feel like I'm making up for lost time. Like I go running, I go swimming.
Right. And the kids push. I mean, one of the things is the justice of growing up is that the kids, if you don't step away, they will push you away most of the time.
Mm-hmm. that's true. Yeah, so now, I mean, I try to do something creative every day if I can, whether that's cooking a meal mm-hmm. or I also like to quilt without patterns. So kind of crazy quilting. And it's just a good outlet to use that part of my brain. And it definitely feels like time for me.
Right, right. And all of these examples of restoring yourself, they're physical.
Yeah.
They're quilting, they're running, they're swimming, they're activities that involve real physical engagement. And is that because the intellectual life is satisfying without having to cultivate it, and the cultivation was something you needed to learn? Or
I think I spent so many years behind a computer that I'm detoxing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's still really hard for me to do email. Yeah. I really just want to be outside in the sun planting and harvesting. And there's something that my agrarian roots are kicking in,
uh-huh.
Making maple syrup in the spring and doing wooding in the fall. And it's just, it's right now, it's such a godsend to be physical that I can't get enough of it. Yeah. And then I do read books.
And the talk mm-hmm. about being with people and the restoring but also mm-hmm. setting limits for yourself.
Yeah, and with the writing, you have to do a certain amount of homework and then be up to speed and then interview someone and then write. And that's all. I love that process. But this one friend of my mom's said, so tell me about your writing. And I said, yeah. And she goes, is it that you love to have written? And I'm like, yes. She goes, I get it.
That's right. Yes, it's after the output.
I love to have written.
Yes, I like that. I'm partnered with somebody like that. what would you like to close the show with today?
I would love to close with Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Okay. And do you want to say anything about this or just play it?
I think we could just play it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Carrie, it has been wonderful to get to know you.
Thank you so much, Eric.
What a wonderful world. dream that you dare to